dealing with this crisis.
Well, thank you, Melissa and Sharad, for inviting me back, and it's always great to be on your program. As you know, the Bantuan Prihatin National Program has been the main form of cash assistance for vulnerable households and individuals during the crisis. The first round of BPN was dispersed in April and May, and the first phase of the second round of BPN was dispersed in October, with the second phase scheduled to come in January. The coverage of BPN is broad, as it includes both the B40 and the M40, covering households earning 8,000 ringgits or less and individuals earning 4,000 ringgits or less. Its coverage is clearly broader than Malaysia's flagship cash transfer program, the Bantuan Sara Hidup, which covers the B40. This broader coverage, particularly during the period of the first MCO between March and May, was particularly welcome, as the stringent mobility restrictions implemented then prevented workers from earning incomes, especially informal workers and those with jobs that cannot be performed from home. Many of these workers also do not have EPF accounts, as you know, which means that they were unable to benefit from the early withdrawals of 500 ringgits per month from the EPF's account too, that was announced early in the crisis. Mm. Now, in terms of depth, you were asking, Melissa, the total yes. support from the BPN ranges between 800 ringgits for M40 single individuals to around 2,600 ringgits for B40 households. The benefit level or the depth is significant, particularly for B40 households. The benefit level, some of which, you know, well, going back to the benefit level, you know, without this, the B40 households would not be able really to go forward, as many of them have lost their sources of income. A study has also shown, that one that was conducted by UNICEF on PPR residents in Kuala Lumpur, that almost 60% of these households found that BPN to be the most useful form of assistance among the other measures introduced, including rental exemptions and social assistance from the Department of Social Welfare during the COVID crisis.
Feroz, very simply, can this government afford this level of assistance, and for how long?
Well, I think at the moment it can. The question, Sharad, is then what happens with the crisis going forward, and whether the high levels of transmission that we're seeing now continue on to the first quarter of 2021, or is it the second quarter? I think then the government will have to rethink what they are planning to do, and possibly to extend the cash transfer assistance. I think that would definitely be needed by the bottom 40.
Feroz, how do you think governments should think about precisely this issue of funding this kind of assistance, and how us as a public concerned about whether the government can sustain it, and who ultimately will have to pay for this? And is it going to come out of our natural resources? Is it going to come from higher taxation? How should that mix be done in a way that is sustainable and also just?
Well, I think it's going to have to come from a combination of sources. I think naturally, you know, the government will have to spend the money, and obviously will have to finance, you know, the deficit. And as you know, Sharad, when you're in a war, you have to do what it takes to win that war. And Malaysia, you know, clearly is not there yet. So I think the overall approach should be one of spending what it takes, but also keeping in mind that, you know, there is a medium term agenda and a fiscal sustainability agenda that needs to be preserved. Now, we did see that the government did announce certain medium term fiscal measures. So there is a, you know, a framework in place for revenue and thinking about revenues more in the medium term. And that's very important, because Malaysia does only collect around 17% to 18% of revenues as a percentage of GDP. And that's quite low for an upper middle income country. And in fact, for high income countries, it's, you know, over 30%. So as Malaysia goes forward beyond this crisis, it will have to think of how to expand its revenue base. But for now, I think the focus should be on trying to get out of the storm and to protect the vulnerable individuals and households that need help.
Right. So some of the incentives that were announced under the economic stimulus packages, also announced under Budget 2021, has been about allowing withdrawals from EPF Account 1. I'm wondering, Firas, are allowing EPF Account 1 withdrawals, is that an effective measure to help distressed households?
Well, permitting early withdrawals from EPF Account 1 balances has both advantages and drawbacks. It does alleviate the financial burden of households and consequently props up domestic demand during a crisis. But it also affects, as you know, the income security of Malaysians during retirement and will not necessarily help the B40, many of whom do not have EPF accounts or have very low balances. It will, however, help some of the M40, particularly those who have lost their jobs or experienced a reduction in income. Now, on this point, our analysis from a recently launched report on population aging in Malaysia indicates that prior to the crisis, almost 75% of EPF members had account balances below 250,000 ringgits at age 54. Such a balance would translate into a monthly retirement benefit of less than 1,050 ringgits. So clearly, the allowance of early withdrawals will further reduce the adequacy of old age income benefits for EPF members in the future. So there's a trade-off between supporting in the immediate term and then trying to protect income security after retirement.
Well, I understand that the World Bank had also proposed perhaps slowly increasing the age of withdrawals for EPF. And I'm wondering, you know, this is not the first time that you've made that proposal. How popular has that been in terms of reception to that proposal? Is that something that will go down easily with the Malaysian public?
Yes, I think, you know, as you alluded to, Melissa, we did include this recommendation in our report in July, the Malaysia Economic Monitor, which focused on strengthening the social protection system in Malaysia. And our point back then was that COVID-19 exposed and revealed some of the underlying weaknesses of Malaysia's social assistance systems and also its social insurance system. And with regards to social insurance, you know, as I said earlier, I think the government has to try to strike a balance between assisting people and giving them the flexibility to draw on their retirement balances, but also trying to protect them because a large number of Malaysians, and this is a fact, they do not have enough income security upon retirement. So the government has to think of what it has to do now to protect these individuals in the future. And more recently, as I said, we launched a report on the country's population aging phenomena, and Malaysia is an aging country at the moment. It's more than, you know, 7% of its population is over 65 years and older, and this is going to, you know, increase with time. So within our estimation, 24 years, Malaysia will become an aged nation, and this will create more and more pressure to ensure that the elderly, senior citizens who want to live out their golden years have enough protection to do so.
Well, I'm looking forward to my golden years, Firas. But before we get to that moment in time, weaknesses also in the economy. What does the World Bank see in terms of, or is it too early to tell, what kind of structural weaknesses are in our economy as a result exposed by this pandemic?
Well, I think the big question, Sharad, is, you know, more medium term, how do you recover from COVID-19, and then how do you begin preparing the country for its eventual transition to a high income and developed country. And we think, in our estimation, that transition may happen in the next 4 or 5 years, or possibly 8 years. But within this decade, Malaysia is going to do that. And we think it must focus on a number of things. It should start to reinvigorate the drivers of long-term economic growth and those consist of investment, both public and private, increasing productivity growth, getting more women into the labor market, that's very important, and improving human capital outcomes. But then there are, you know, agendas related to improving competitiveness, creating enough high-quality jobs, supporting inclusion, and this is a big agenda of the government to really promote shared prosperity, and then improving the quality of government services, so focusing on institutions. But another big agenda, and I alluded to this in the beginning, was, you know, making sure that Malaysia has enough revenues to actually finance this transition, and that's where, you know, all of these medium-term strategies to think about revenues is very important. So I would focus on those things.
Well, Firas, always a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for being on the show. It's a delight. Thank you. That's all for you on this episode of Consider This. Thank you so much for watching. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan, signing off the evening.
Good night.